Welcome to the Supertone Show. The show is co-hosted by Simon Campbell.
That's me.
And myself, Susie Starlight. And today we're going to be playing some music and talking about a chap who's been hugely influential in the British blues scene in the 1960s. He's produced hundreds of albums, worked with absolutely tons of people. And Mick Fleetwood from Fleetwood Mac says that this chap deserves tremendous kudos for his guidance, not only in their career, but for many others in the English blues scene too. He did more than anyone knows to further the music and nurture the artists.
But who is he?
Well, it's Mike Vernon. For Your Loving, John Mayall and the Blues Breakers.
Amazing track, and one that I have listened to many times.
I really love that track, actually. I love the bass.
The bass. We're just into the show about 3 or 4 minutes and already we're talking about bloody bass.
It's quite hypnotic, though.
Yeah. Well, John McVie, I mean, he was an amazing bass player. And but, I mean, that was one of the albums that really set off the British blues explosion. And,
yes.
Of course, I listened to it many times, but I didn't realise that Mike Vernon had actually produced it.
No.
That's the incredible thing. I mean, I know more about the technical stuff, like, you know, Clapton and his Blues Breaker 2x12, you know, which was pretty new at the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, the fact he had it on so loud that the engineer didn't want to record it or something?
I think he had to get that sound. When I was just doing some research on it, he just whacked it up really loud, and they just, you know, it's like they had to just like run with it really, because no one had ever recorded anything like that before. Like,
of course,
screaming
loud,
screaming,
yeah, screaming rock and
to
roll
to get
guitar.
That distortion, that sound that he was after.
Of course, yeah. I mean, it does sound, because they're after trying to get a live sound. That's what they say from there, and it was, you know, it does sound very alive. The drums, everything's like very homogeneous and beautiful, you know. It sounds like it's all together, doesn't it?
Yeah, and this is the weird thing. So when he realised, like, so obviously we know this album, then we found out that Mike was actually involved in producing it. And then you go back one more, and when he started off working for Decca, he was just totally into the blues from everything that I've been reading about him. And he was going to see John Mayall play at the Flamingo, and he went to his boss at the time and just said, look, you're going to have to sign these guys because there's something happening. The ex-Yardbirds guitarist Clapton's just completely turning blues upside down, and they're onto something. And so that's kind of how they got signed by all accounts. So So Mike Vernon was actually key and instrumental in getting John Mayall re-signed.
Blimey.
And that's quite beautiful for a blues lover, isn't it? To be out there loving the music, just saying, we've got to do it, and then going into the studio and actually aiming to record an album that sounds live.
Yeah.
And not realising at the time just how amazingly historic this album was going to be.
Yeah. That's right. It really did kick it off, and it was after that that lots of other things started happening. And John Mayall, after this, he got Peter Green involved, didn't he?
Yeah, he did, because it was in the charts. This is the weirdest thing, you know, because nowadays, really, I suppose the charts aren't, it's not the same. Everything, things have changed, but in those days, this album was in the charts for 17 weeks.
Yeah. A blues album, oh yeah.
Yeah, and exactly, blues as well. It was mainstream. It was totally in the middle of everything. Mm. And by the time it had dropped off the charts, Clapton had already left the Blues Breakers.
And formed Cream.
Exactly, yeah. And Peter Green had joined.
And that was about the time, because I think it was this album that kicked off Clapton Is God, because that was all over London, wasn't
it?
Spread on walls and stuff, Clapton Is God, you know?
Yeah, I remember there was another thing as well that was saying that obviously Clapton was quite sort of, he admits himself he was a bit egotistical, but he kind of saw John Mayall as a father figure.
Mm.
So when he joined, and they were just before they were going to do this album, apparently Mike and John Mayall played records to Eric by Freddie King, Otis Rush, and all the Chicago greats, you know, just looking at the sounds and experimenting with, you know, where they were going to aim for, what they were going to aim for, really, the sound.
But I think the interesting thing is it got a very unique sound, because it was a sound of Britain. It wasn't the sound of Chicago, really. It wasn't a sound that anybody had ever heard before. And this was when it started, or when we started, to resell the blues back to America. You know, because these artists, you know, they were massive in America, and because the Americans didn't realise what they had until we went back with it, you know?
So, in a nutshell, if you could say something, what would you say would be the sound of the British blues from that time then?
Well, this is it. I mean, this and early Fleetwood Mac. And in fact, talking about Fleetwood Mac, The Stumble by John Mayall's Blues Breakers, featuring Peter Green on guitar. Now,
what? Well, what?
I think Peter Green is a much better player than Eric.
Ooh.
Absolutely. And the whole sound, I'm sorry, Eric, I do love you. I love your playing. EC Was Here was an amazing record, beautiful record, really inspired me. But Peter Green, his use of notes, his use of tone, his use, his feel for the blues was incredible. And to think that this was the next record right after the Beano album that we heard before, of course, with Eric Clapton, it's incredible. So within a couple of years, was it, you mm-hmm. know, or 1 year, these two were both recorded. And, of course, Peter Green then went on to form Fleetwood Mac. But they were both recorded at Decca Studios, Broadhurst Gardens. And, you know, even now, and this is before I knew all this, but we've actually got some, in our studio, we've actually got some Broadhurst Gardens gear, some remakes of that early Decca gear. And I didn't even know. But also the sound of this, I think, is a lot more polished. It's more controlled. It's not quite as messy as the Beano. I know they wanted to make it sound live, the sort of Beano, but this is more controlled. Unfortunately, I think they've stereoed it afterwards, and it was probably originally recorded in mono, I think it was. And you listen on this, it's not quite as good because the drums are panned to the left and you've got the keyboards on the right, and it does sound a bit odd to me.
Yeah.
Like a lot of these tracks did then, because the Beatles did it, of course, you know, when they remastered. I prefer them in mono, but...
Yeah.
But anyway, yeah, it's an incredible song. And one of the first things I learnt on guitar, after learning me that the first five Led Zeppelin albums, I went on to this.
It's actually, it's like a workout, isn't it, really? Because for me, I picture the bass when I learned this piece last year. It's like this baby elephant with a euphonium, because it's... It seems a little bit... it feels like the bass is very simple, and it's lum ba dum ba dum ba dum ba dum ba dum and dum dum ba dum dum ba dum. It's kind of, it's not too fancy. It's just pretty, just rhythmic.
But the groove, you know, and there's no doubt about it. I mean, I mean, John Mayall's keyboard playing is eclipsed by his ability to get great musicians playing with him and picking great tunes. Mm. And actually, you know, because I think he was a father figure for British blues. I mean, people talk about Alexis Corner, which of course came before him. But, you know, John Mayall for me was really the complete instrument and the tool of taking British blues from essentially obscurity right into the limelight, you know.
And isn't it funny, you've got Mike Vernon and Decca going out and really encouraging artists, and from what I gather, he's when they went to record this album, Mike didn't know that Clapton had left.
Yeah.
Because I was reading a comment saying that Mike had said, "I was in a shock state, but John said, 'Don't worry, we've got someone better.'"
There you are.
But Mike's quoted here in this piece, like this article I read, saying, wait a minute, what, you've got someone better than Eric Clapton?" John Mayall replied, "He might not be better now, but you wait in a couple of years, he's going to be the best."
Well, there we are.
Isn't that interesting?
You know, and he really, you know, he really did it for me, Peter Green. It was so sad what happened, you know, when he had that bad trip and his career, you know, descended into...
Didn't they say with Peter Green that he played like a human as opposed to a superstar, and that's really where he connected as well with his playing? He wasn't so showy, he was more feeling, he had the feel.
Yeah, I think Peter Green, I mean, you know, Peter Green's voice as well, that's a big thing about it, and people forget that he was a singer as well. Mm. And, you know, I mean, like Man of the World, my God, what a great song. You know, and he was a songwriter. So to me, he was a complete performer, he was a complete guitar player, an understood tone of his guitar, but also he understood the nuances of what he was playing. I mean, that track he delivered, which essentially is a cover, of course, a Freddie King cover.
Yeah.
And you know, but he actually delivered something far better than the original, in my opinion, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Rather like Hendrix did with All Along the Watchtower. Because you don't actually get much worse than the original by Bob. Sorry, Bob, we love you, but you can't sing and you can't play guitar. You write great songs, though.
I read something about that, about Hendrix actually deciding to sing, because he thought, well, you know, if Bob Dylan can get away with singing, then he gave it a crack as well.
Yeah.
Isn't it interesting?
Well, it is.
So we've got in common then with these two albums, Mr. Vernon.
Yeah.
Who's there encouraging people. And I think the one thing that I'm starting to come through is we get a sense of Mike as a producer is his passion for the blues and also his willingness to let things happen, to capture what's there, to not mess with something if it's not broken, and to capture that kind of energy of as much as possible of live.
Yeah, well, if I had a hat on, I would take it off to him.
But it's interesting because we've got so much in common, yet we've not actually met Mike in person yet.
I know.
Isn't
well,
it
hopefully,
odd?
in some not too distant future, we will. But anyway,
let's move on
to one of my all time favourites. Well, not particularly a favourite guitar player, but he was one that was really central in my growing up as a guitar player.
Thank you.
I Can't Keep From Crying Sometimes by 10 Years After from the first album. Alvin Lee.
Alvin.
In spectacular form there. Because, of course, he's known for his blistering speed.
Yeah, I almost didn't recognise him then because it was really considered and laid back.
Very, all those double stops. Beautiful, you know, really beautiful stuff. And the groove was really cool.
I love the feel of that track.
Yeah, it fantastic. And of course, you know, Bill and Alvin Lee went on to do Going Home and Woodstock and all those things. But this was the first record after Mike Vernon picked him up, really.
Yeah, apparently Mike saw them at Windsor Jazz and Blues Festival and they had like a standing ovation to a 20,000-strong crowd.
Blimey.
So he got them signed straight up to Durham Label.
Yeah, Durham Label, of course, it was part of Decca. This again done at Broadus Gardens, I think, and also... Durham was formed, I think, for the Moody Blues to do the first stereo album.
Stereo.
It was a stereo thing going on. But just going back to the track, I mean, again, it's more considered than the Beano album. I think it's a lot, you know, it's a lot more open and beautiful. And I say Alvin's playing's great. I mean, when I was, you know, growing up again with guitar, he was one of my heroes, you know.
Yeah.
I remember on when I was at school with Fletch, and if you're out there, Stephen Fletcher, hello. Fletch, we used to draw little diagrams of what our stage was going to be like when we got older, you know, what our stage, and we had like big stacks of Marshalls, and Fletch was a drummer, and he had his drum kit set up, and we used to do these little drawings, you know, with us on them. So, you know, we were already thinking we were going to be rock and rollers, you know, then. I was probably, I don't know, 15. 16 when I just started playing. So, yeah. But the funny thing is, of course, is that we met Evie Lee.
Without knowing, actually, until we left.
That's right, because Evie Lee, that's Alvin's wife, the late Alvin, of course, because the console that we have in the studio is a Trident Vector, and he used it quite extensively when he lived in Spain.
Yeah.
So, in fact, this console, that this very podcast is being recorded through the mic channels, was used by the wonderful Alvin Lee towards the end of his career. Fantastic.
Yeah, absolutely fantastic. But that, actually, though, was a lovely song to choose, I think, for the podcast because I think with the 10 Years After, as I get to know now, you are, as you say, you are used to hearing Alvin play like a lightning.
Yeah, that's right.
So nice to have a different feel. And it's quite evocative of images, isn't it? A feel of a time, I think, that track.
Yeah.
Very much so.
Fantastic.
And again, what do they have in common? Mr. Mike Vernon.
Yes, Mike Vernon.
Mike!
The man behind the sound of the 60s.
It's incredible. How wonderful, though. This is actually very exciting because it's like, what? And it's like opening up a treasure box.
It is.
And there's more and more and more and more. And you just think, no way. You go, yeah. Because, of course, the other thing as well, you know, is just 2 years after the success of the Beano.
Not 10 years after.
No. Oh, but that's bad.
It was bad.
That was a bad one. It was a bad, good one. Mike actually left Decca because he started his cult Blue Horizon record label. A lot to do with Peter Green, apparently. He wanted to release his new music with Fleetwood Mac on Blue Horizon.
Right, okay.
And I think Mike offered it to Decca, but they said no. He recorded it there, and I think it was they said no. And anyway, he got a distribution deal with CBS. And then, of course, he couldn't really produce them for another company. So then I think basically what he did is he went freelance and then went back.
Right.
As you do. So we've got the Blue Horizon as well as the Cult Blues label.
Well, this next track must have been released in the Blue Horizon because, you know, and I think it's because our love of these bands. We're actually majoring out on just a few artists tonight. So anyway, get your dancing shoes on and shake your booty or your ass.
Shake Your Money Maker by Fleetwood Mac. Do you know, I didn't know that Fleetwood Mac was named after Mick Fleetwood and Mac V.
Well, John Mac V, yeah. Well,
yeah, I didn't know, because how would you know?
Well, you wouldn't, would you, really? No. Unless you thought about it. But, of course, to me, this is the real Fleetwood Mac, not the bogus Fleetwood Mac
that
went over to the States and did all that stuff. You know, this is the real, and it's that track's got energy. And if you listen to it, there's certainly no click track on that. Towards the end, they're speeding up like fuck. They're like, you're going out of control. They're like, you know, and they're really obviously very excited. But it's fantastic. It has energy. The sound is so real and immediate. It's just great.
And the bass is great because, do you know what it is? It's bass. Simple. Well, there's sometimes you get like this funky stuff coming into blues bass, and sometimes what I really like is the simple, clear dum 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 dum, just to drive it, you know,
and it
with
does.
The drums, just to get it in to give it that great tight rhythm section.
Well, they're an amazing rhythm section. Like, yeah, and Mick Fleetwood. I mean, my God, you know, they're great. And listen to that. But you see, it was dusted off with this magnificent guitar playing and energy, you know. It was tremendous. Anyway, absolutely tremendous. So, is there anything else about our track we should be knowing about?
Well, apparently the whole thing that started off was that John Mayall gave Peter Green some studio time for his birthday present.
Blimey.
What a great present, eh?
Absolutely.
So that's how he got Mick Fleetwood and McVean to record some instrumentals. And then Peter Green was going to move to Chicago because he wanted to go and play with local bands, and he had this dream that he was going to move out there and just absorb the music scene in Chicago, and it didn't happen. So Mike Vernon persuaded him to form a trio group with Mick Fleetwood on drums, who'd just been dumped by John Mayall, apparently. And one bass player later, John McVie, came in. He didn't quite merge with Mayall and his more jazzy inclinations. So it was Mike who persuaded Peter to form Fleetwood Mac and do a trio. Ah, but also because the other thing as well, I mean, it's expectations are really hard, aren't they? And you think about Peter Green going into the Blues Breakers after Clapton's moved on. Mm. So you've got that kind of shadow as well of filling, you know, of moving into that place as guitarist. And I think what Mike sort of helped this new band as well, because he also suggested adding Jeremy Spencer into the band so that he wouldn't be just the sole guitar player, because Jeremy Spencer was a slide guitar player. So you've got this kind of, as they describe in this piece I wrote, quite interestingly, a somewhat schizophrenic blend of Spencer's up-tempo blues and vintage rock and roll with Peter Green's subtler blues rock style.
Which was, of course, demonstrated in that last track.
Yeah. So that was quite interesting. So Mike's, you know, he's there. People are ringing him up. He's mentoring people. He's talking. He's feeling it, you know. He's working with people and their sensibilities as well.
That's fantastic.
There's something else which I didn't know. This is to do with Mike, by the way, but you know Jeremy Spencer.
Yeah.
Did you know that when he used to play live, I don't know if I can say it even.
Go on.
He used to bring on stage a 16-inch dildo called Harold.
No.
Sorry.
Dildo. 16 inch. Yeah. Good God.
The thing is, you see, my father's middle name was Harold as well. So anyway, how obscure is that? And the other thing was that he had a Bible sewn into the lining of his coat. I just giggled. I didn't want to tell you this. Because
what did he do with this dildo on stage?
I don't know. I think he just placed it on stage somewhere. Harold?
Well, there we are. So, well, that's certainly, I didn't know that. So that's new.
Anyway.
What we do for this show is that we do separate bits of research, so Start, I'll do some, and I'll do some. So the first time we talk about it is right now, which is always good, you know, because a bit more spontaneity.
Well, it's got to be fresh. And also, there are things that you know that I don't know. And I like to learn, you know. I want to ask you things. And it's keeping it real.
Well, indeed, yeah. I think anyway, here as well, just a bit of a technical note. I think at this stage, old Peter Green had onto using Matamp and Orange amps, of course.
Right, okay.
I think probably Matamp, and that were later made, famous, or they were famous for. That was Wishbone Ash and our friend Andy Powell.
Andy.
Yeah. So who we met a few
Top
weeks
man.
Ago. Lovely bloke. Great band still, you know, still out there touring. So,
yeah,
you know, Orange amps. And one other thing, which is really interesting. It's a long time ago now. But I went actually into the Matamp factory and met Matt Mathias, who was the inventor of the Matamp, which then became rebadged Orange or remarketed by Cliff Cooper at Orange. And I remember walking around the workshop, and on the shelf there was all these old 200-watt slave amps and heads and stuff. And Matt picked this box up, and he said, this is a preamp I made for Peter Green. Well, I nearly fell to the floor as though, I am not worthy. I just couldn't believe it. So I was looking at it, and I actually picked it up, and I felt a shiver. It was a shiver of I don't know what it was, but it was a shiver anyway. And he made this preamp, yeah, for Peter Green. So there you are. So, and of course, Matt and I were based in Huddersfield, which is amazing.
Really?
Yeah. And Matt Mathias, I think he was Polish, Matt, but lovely bloke, very good engineer. And those amps, you could drop them off the back of a bus and they'd still work. They're like built like brick shit houses, honestly. And talking of brick shit houses, let's get on to the next track.
Well, I am superstitious. Black cat just crossed my trail. superstitious. Black cat just crossed my trail. Down to sweep me with no broom. I just might get put in jail. When my right hand is him, I get money for sure. When my right hand is him, I get money for sure. But when my left eye jump in, somebody gotta go. Oh, the dog down the howl, the whole way down in the neighborhood. Well, the dog down the howl, I say the whole way down in the neighborhood. Baby, that's the truth, and I did. You know that ain't no good. You know ain't superstitious. Gotta go do some back and forth.
Ain't Superstitious by Savoy Brown. Another Vernon band. And we actually, I mean, there's a little bit of stuff on Wikipedia, and there's a lot of lineup changes due to a shifty manager, which was the guitarist's brother, apparently, and I don't think he paid anybody, yeah. And they kept changing the lineup all the time. But a very interesting sound, and that's the reason why we've got it, because it's sort of almost, it's a cross between that Fleetwood Mac thing and the early John Mayall sort of sound.
Yeah.
You know? But again, lovely guitar playing. And, you know, when people talk to me now about guitar players and the guitar players that you see now and the young people, you know, there's a lot of them out there are doing fantastic work. They really are. But you listen to this original stuff and it was proper good, you know. It's proper good. And the young people, you know, that are actually doing stuff now are very, obviously, you know, almost religious about listening to these early people because you feel a lot of it. But I do think that the sound has changed slightly. I do think that the modern guitar sound, and this is just me, I perhaps steeped in the 60s, whatever. Of course, I was only born in 58, so I'm not all that, you know, I can't remember the 60s, really. But that sound, that guitar sound, was something very much about that time. And yeah. I think that now has been lost. It's got more overdriven, it's got more soft, it's got more, you know, and perhaps it needs to move on, you know. But I always hark back when I hear a guitar sound. I like listening to Peter Green and Eric Clapton, those early ones, and Alvin and, you know, and Jeff Beck and Page at the time, and listen to what they were doing. And... And that guitar sound really typifies what was going on at that sort of period.
And the notes, or the lack of the notes sometimes, the simplicity.
Yeah, that's right.
That I love, because it helps with the feel. It's not showing off. It's really just focused on feel for me. Anyway, that's why I really enjoy it. I enjoy that era because of that as well. I know you get different songs that are busy, but a lot of the time it you can really connect with it because it feels something. It gets you going, doesn't it, really?
Absolutely. Yeah, totally. But, of course, talking about getting you going, I remember that when we were driving to London in the van of rock, that's our white Volkswagen Transporter van, going south, and we had some music on in the van. And all of a sudden, I put this track on.
And it felt like you'd put two cables from the battery of the van into my left and right ear and connected me up to an electrical charge that completely and utterly frazzled my head.
Yeah.
I'd never heard anything like it before.
Well, nobody had heard anything like it because there wasn't anything like it before this.
I didn't know what to think.
Yeah, and I mean, and again, which I didn't realise, Vernon was instrumental in this band as well, and I had no idea until I started looking him up. And this guy is, well, I'm going to talk to you about it a bit later about this guy, but he's probably the most underrated guitar player of all time.
Incredible, intensely entertaining Hocus Pocus by Focus.
Unbelievable. Now that's live, absolutely live, live at the Rainbow. And that guitar playing, it's sensitive, it's funny, it's melodic, it's quick. He's got exactly the right sound. He's absolutely fucking remarkable, that fella. Absolutely. You know, and as long as I walk on this planet, I can't even get close to what he can do. And I just love him. I love him, you know. He's one of my favourite guitar players of all time. Incredible. And you know, and but the band.
Jan Akerman. And Pia van der Linden.
Yeah. The whole thing is, you know, incredible. Theus van Leer. I mean, his voice, his flute playing, his organ playing, everything. The band, you know, Bert Reiter on bass. Remarkable. And this was supervised by Mike Vernon, because Mike Vernon actually recorded the studio albums, which I didn't know. So the studio album, Moving Waves and Focus 3, and those tracks he'd actually recorded. So
can you imagine, though, what he must have thought? Well, I don't know.
Yeah, well, I mean,
but I bet he had a big grin, because who wouldn't have a big grin when you hear that?
Well, when you see him on...
It's incredible.
Ogre Whistle Test. You look at my Ogre Whistle Test and it's
every
hilarious.
Time you watch the Ogre Ray Whistle Test, I can't stop giggling. I think, no, I'm not going to giggle the same. And it just gets under your skin, and before you know it, you're just laughing your head off.
His eyes are popping out when he goes to those really high notes. They're bulging right
Have
out
Have you ever
there.
Thought, though, because it evokes lots of pictures. Can you imagine what the video would have looked like if they'd...
No, I can't, actually.
You know, I just thinking that, because to me it's like a mash of like Julie Andrews with Wurzel Gummidge on speed at times. Yeah. Oh, and it's just like, it's crazy. It's all mashed up.
Yeah, it's incredible. And Akerman, the reason why I love his, guitar playing, but he sounds great, you know? Mm. And he was using, I think it was a Fender PA amp with all the inputs linked together, and a Framus guitar. And, you know, I mean, it's stuff that just wasn't being used in those days. But, and it's playing. I mean, there's not one blues lick in there, really. It's just, you know, crazy. But, you know, we have to thank Mike Vernon for those incredible studio albums and the band, of course, and supervising Live at the Rainbow, which that's a track from.
Yeah, I really don't know what else you could say now.
Well, you can't.
Because... Yeah. It's
truly original.
Yeah,
that's just as original as Radiohead. I mean, Radiohead, when you know, when they did Kid A and all that stuff, it was just as remarkable. It's like being slapped in the face with a wet haddock, slap, and then again, slap,
and
slap,
electrified
slap,
with up your culo
that's
as well.
Exactly, yeah, that's
because you just
right.
don't know how to even respond.
No, you don't. Well, you know, I think it's probably just worth talking a little bit about the fact why we haven't done a podcast for 12 months nearly now.
Yeah, we made a. Well, we were writing, weren't we, recording our new album, Blueberry Pie.
Yeah, and last April, because I think our last podcast was the middle of April, 24th of April last year, and we'd just started writing the album, or we'd written most of it by then, hadn't we?
Yeah, because what we did, we decided that we were going to write a new album together, a new blues album, especially because if you've listened to a lot of the other podcasts, you know, the blues, especially with me playing bass, is really connected with me.
What, you play bass, do you?
Sometimes. Shut up. So anyway, with the bass playing, we decided we were going to write an album together. So over a couple of weeks, we wrote most of the album, and then we set about recording it. So Steve Gibson and Johnny Henderson. Steve Gibson on drums, Johnny Henderson on keys.
Yeah.
Hammond organ, Wurlitzer. And we had Danny Boy Sanchez on harp. And
it took us, because after we wrote it, we organised it all.
Yeah.
We always had coming across, and we booked the time at our own studio, and just did it, didn't we?
Yeah, we did.
But it's been all-consuming, hasn't it?
It has really as well, because we're a small independent label too, so a lot of the relationships are building with radio presenters and magazines, and it's, you know, it is a labour of love just to, once you've recorded it, to and get it, and obviously John Astley mastered it.
Yeah, marvellous.
Marvellous. Yeah. I mean, yeah. I think, and then, so that's why we haven't done the podcast, because we were getting Blueberry Pie made, basically.
Yeah. And then.
Yeah, and we gave everything and more, and I can't believe how...
It nearly killed us, actually.
Yeah, how wonderful, though. I just want to tell you, when we hear our songs on the radio, or when we read a review, or when once even just somebody says, "Hey, I heard your new album," and they love it, it means so much to us, because you never know. And the whole point about the music is that we're writing it to share, you know.
Yeah, and funnily enough, when we were sort of writing it, because I really wanted to do something that was, because I love this British blues thing, and that 60s sound, I wanted to capture that 60s sound again, try and get that sound, you know, because I love it, and I grew up with it. And then we sort of started listening to it, then we did some more research and found that Mike Vernon was instrumental in
exactly.
a lot of it, which was quite remarkable. And I mean, recently I've been doing a lot of videos and articles on how to record things like guitar, drums, and bass, because people have been asking us after we've done it, because it is it's a different sound than what you're hearing right now. I don't want to go into it too much. You can listen to it yourself. It's on Spotify, and you can buy it if you want. And this is not a plug for the record, really. It's just to say, really, why we haven't been engaged in our regular podcasting activities.
And the funny thing is, as well, getting back onto topic as well with Mike, is that I actually connected up on Facebook with him like probably 2 years ago, as a fellow Brit, really, who was actually living in the south of Spain, and I had no idea.
Yeah. And I sent him an email, and then I looked him up, found out what he did. I thought, oh dear. So
he was like, oh, wonderful. But it's just because you just didn't know, you know, because he was singing, and you just, you know, he's like, hi, and you're like, hi, and that's it, really. And then it was only after, as you say, this whole journey that you just go, what? No way.
Indeed.
Yes way. Indeed. Which brings us on, I think, to our final track of our special Mike Vernon podcast.
Yeah, and I think this is suitably fitting, because, you know, blues did change, and it changed, you know, during that period, and Fleetwood Mac changed, and so did, you know, Peter Green. And this is one of the few tracks tonight that is actually self-penned, because he wrote this. Although many people don't know, but he did. And has been covered by lots of people. Famously, Carlos Santana covered it. A great version, actually, Carlos Santana.
Yeah,
I love it.
That's the version I knew.
I love the guitar playing, you know. But this is Peter Green as a writer and a singer and a remarkable guitar player.
Got a black magic woman. Got a black magic woman. Yes, I got a black magic woman. Got me so blind I can't see. That she's a black magic woman, and she's trying to make the devil out of me. Don't turn your back on me, baby.
don't turn your back on me, baby. Yes, don't turn your back on me, baby. You're messing around with your tricks. Don't turn your back on me, baby, 'cause you might just break up my magic spell. You got your spell on me, baby. You got your spell on me, baby. Yes, you got your spell on me, baby. Turning my heart into stone. I need you so bad, magic woman, I can't leave you alone.
Magic Woman, Fleetwood Mac. I love that song.
Well, it is. It's classic. And a lot of people said it was this era was the pinnacle of British blues. And I think it was, you know.
And you can feel that when Peter Green's playing, he's speaking. You can feel that.
Like Ackerman. I mean, that's the thing. I mean, Ackerman was a different, completely different style, but Ackerman's speaking. Peter Green's speaking.
You do that as well, just, you know, but moving on.
Well, thank you. That's no, you lovely. Do. You know, to be mentioned in the same
But that, that's how I feel well, about your playing anyway. Yeah, so we've got this amazing British blues explosion that happened. And before, really, like a few years ago, I didn't really know anything about it. I didn't know the names of half the people involved because I just knew songs, you know. I was into the music. I didn't know what had gone in to create them. And, you know, it's like when you've got your friends, you know, your mates come around, you're jamming and you're hanging out. You don't know who made what and did what. And it's quite inspirational, actually, just to find out how that this happened and why. Why did it happen?
Well, you know, it was a scene, wasn't it? And scenes develop and people they drive a scene forward. And I think Vernon and John Mayall and Alexis Corner were people who drove it and actually got a scene happening.
Mm.
You know, because the Rolling Stones came from the Alexis Corner era and they were doing arts. They brought really the original British blues, and it was these guys now in the sort of second wave of British blues with Mayall that got it from Chicago. It's more Chicago blues style, you know. But I'm humbled by when I listen to these tracks and hear the beauty and excellence of the playing and the songwriting, and considering it was all done live as well. Yeah. No fucking about. It was just done live. They went in the studio, they plugged in, and they did it. Then they went to the pub, and that was it. None of this tooling around with editing, you know, and all that. And that is what we are missing right now. And that is what Supertone, and that is what we, you know, we're trying to do. With Blueberry Pie, you know, as much as possible, we tried to do that. But unfortunately, I was engineering it and producing it at the same time, so I had a mop up my own ass as well. But it was... But anyway, I mean, it's a remarkable period in British history, really, in British music history.
Yeah, and also the one thing that really comes home to me and strikes me about this time was it started off with Mike's passion and love for the blues. Mm. And that when he started off working at Decca, he knew it was a bit fuddy-duddy and he wanted to make it relevant and fresh. And he was a gopher, apparently, for a few years. And it's great to know that there was someone out there who really loved blues music and really helped encourage the artist as well. It wasn't just like a money thing. It was totally and utterly... yeah, interested in the people as well as the music. Yeah. That comes across. I mean, hopefully one day our paths will meet and we'll share some stories. But you know, all due respect and bloody good on you, I'd say, yeah. Mr. Vernon. And I want to close with this one quote from John Mayall. Actually, he says about Mike Vernon that Mike had the foresight not to mess with something that was happening live, to just get it done on tape. Keeping all the spontaneity and feel.
Mm. And that is the role of the producer. So that's the next one, and the first one of this next series that we're going to do, of the producers.
Yeah.
So we'll look forward to seeing you next time. I'm Simon Campbell.
I'm Susie Starlight. Right then.
Oh, that was... a bit of Ross on Y coming out there. Detective.
Can do occasionally.
Anyway, we'll see you next time.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
¶¶